Next case is United States v. Carter. Appellant ready? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Alex Hess. Major Kyle Sprague and I represent the appellant in this case, Private First Class Gerald Carter. May I have 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor?
Granted.
Your Honor, of the three granted issues, I'd actually like to begin with issue two regarding the government's discovery gamesmanship at trial. The military judge found that the government intentionally withheld evidence of the bribery allegation and then ambushed the defense with it in front of the members in order to smear the accused and the witness. However, he abused his discretion in not granting a mistrial for all of the specifications because he overlooked two issues. First, he misunderstood the scope and the devastating nature of this ambush bribery allegation. And second, his instruction actually allowed the government to profit off its own misconduct by limiting a third-party defense.
And when you say the military judge didn't seem to grasp the seriousness of the situation, it doesn't really appear that way in the record. It seems like, to use an old term, he seemed very cross with trial counsel in this case. But beyond that, he really went out of his way to come up with the curative instructions. And he not only gave those curative instructions, he actually told the panel that he had conducted a hearing outside of their presence and had determined that the bribery allegation was false. Why wasn't that sufficient in your view?
Your Honor, the problem is that he went beyond what would have cured the error, potentially. We submit that even if he told the panel members, disregard the bribery allegation, that that's just simply too powerful of testimony for them to be able to put aside. This is one of those limited circumstances.
But then aren't you wandering into the territory where you're essentially saying that curative instructions won't work with a jury and don't?
Correct.
Haven't we repeatedly said that curative instructions do work with juries?
This court has said that, but there has been recognition that sometimes a panel member, there's evidence that's simply too damaging for a panel to be able to put out of its mind.
And how is this so?
Your Honor, an allegation that was essentially created the impression before the panel members that the accused had bribed a witness on the same.
Are you saying it's a strict liability thing and the judge touches it at his peril?
No, Your Honor. I think, so in the previous case in Diaz, this court said that expert lie detector testimony was too damaging for the curative instruction that was given in that case. In this case, we don't have a third party opining on whether or not the accused was guilty on, or we don't have a third party assessing the viability of the central issue of the case. It appeared to the panel to be coming from the accused himself. That was the impression that the government had made.
What's the standard review of the judge's action?
Your Honor, it's for an abuse of discretion.
It's abuse of discretion, which is a pretty lenient standard, and you're saying, yeah, but this is so horrible that he abused his discretion.
Yes, because it went to the central issue of the case, and it's very powerful. The judge called it a momentous occasion at the trial when this came out.
Well,
so to ask the panel to put that out of their mind is very difficult. And if we look at the results of the trial, I think we can see some evidence of them being unable to put the allegation out of their mind. They came back with findings of guilty on all charges and specifications. It took them less than 2 hours to deliberate for a three-day trial. And when the government asked for a five-year sentence, they came back with eight. So this is a very different situation than in Short, where this court looked at, well, there was sort of a split finding. We think that maybe they were able to put that out of their mind.
To mean instead that the evidence of guilt was so overwhelming and that they were offended by the behavior.
Well, if we look at the evidence in this case, Your Honor, so it's a very technical case that the government put on. Relating to DFEs and forensic evidence, two eyewitnesses came forward and said this was not the individual that we met up with who had been texting us. Of course, one of those witnesses' testimony was discarded given the judge's instructions.
Why doesn't that hurt your position, though? You've got someone else saying the same thing.
I think that's the problem. This other witness comes in and testifies almost identically to the way MR did, and there's this cloud of that the panel can't put out of their mind regarding MR. So to have a second witness come in and say the exact same thing, I think a panel can't help but be reminded of what happened with
MR. Well, yeah, one can conjecture on why the panel did what it did, and I might conjecture that there was something else lurking there, but we'll get to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, may I ask you about the judge's remedy? Looking at it, the judge did two things. The judge declared a mistrial with respect to one specification, and then the judge also directed the panel to disregard all of the witnesses' testimony. And defense counsel didn't object to the disregarding all of the counsel's testimony. But in your appeal, in your brief, you seem to suggest that this was very problematic because MR had some very helpful testimony saying he's not Julio. What do we make of the fact, though, that when the judge said that testimony should be struck, defense counsel didn't object to that? I mean, for example, defense counsel could have said, well, we don't want it all struck. Just tell him believe only the part where, or you can consider only the part that she testified he wasn't Julio. But the defense counsel didn't do that. And was that a waiver of that kind of argument that you're now making on appeal?
No, Your Honor. So when the defense came back and renewed their objection, or I guess asked for reconsideration, at Joint Appendix 408, the military judge asked, well, why wasn't my instruction good enough? And the defense answered, Your Honor, it precludes testimony and it impacts the credibility. So, and that was that triggered the entire discussion about, well, why didn't you then just recall her? And obviously the defense answered there, you know, she was so tainted, there's an optics issue if we were to come back and try to recall her potentially.
Well, you can't have it both ways. You want the testimony, but you don't want to break, you don't want her up there.
I think the problem is the government's misconduct put the defense in a situation where they had no choice. It was either forego this exculpatory testimony from MR or call back a tainted witness and potentially dirty their own hands in trying to prove their case. So the proximate cause of all this problem was the government's misconduct. The judge's instructions didn't help because it excluded whatever helpful testimony that she would have had that potentially the panel could have latched on to if they wanted to. The final point I just want to make on this, the military judge at Joint Appendix 617 in his ruling said that MR's testimony was completely unrelated. That was his words to all the other charges and specifications. And that is simply... That's clearly erroneous based on the way that the government presented and litigated this case to the members. She was there to identify, to link the accused to Julio, and to essentially that underlied all of the remaining charges and specifications, which were all based on, is this the person sending the messages? So that's the final point I guess I want to make on that, pending any questions on issue two, Your Honor. Moving then to the
The IAC.
Yes, Your Honor, the IAC.
Okay.
Your Honor, Gerard provided, the brother provided sworn testimony, confession subject to cross-examination, and at the defense's request, the military judge ruled that they could play that testimony at trial. But despite promising to play it for the panel, defense counsel did not put it in. They were ineffective because Gerard's testimony fit the theory of the case that the defense argued in closing, and the defense did not have a firm factual basis to conclude.
Well, and why didn't he? If he had a good faith belief that this guy didn't exist, that whoever's voice that was wasn't Gerard and was on there to provide an alibi and playing that would constitute fraud on the court, let's assume he had a good faith belief of that. How's that IAC? Remember, what's the standard of IAC is pretty demanding or non-demanding, as you depending on which direction you describe it from.
Your Honor, I don't think that was never a justification that Captain MJ offered in his affidavit. He did not believe, or at least he never averred that he did not believe that Gerard didn't exist.
What about the SF-86?
That was not part of the record, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's not part of the record at all, as the Army Court tried to bring that in. But, again, Captain MJ never talked about any of that.
But what about the fact that the defense's own forensic expert, right, told the defense counsel that what the person said, Gerard, whether he existed or not, could not be true? Could not be true.
I disagree, I guess, with that reading of what the expert's TFE said in his affidavit. This is paragraph 5B. Essentially what he was saying is the self photos taken of the accused were taken on the particular phone that CID seized. And that's it. But that's nothing different than what he had told Captain MJ even before the trial. And more importantly, that does not invalidate the cloud sync theory, which is... Well,
I never did get the cloud sync theory.
Yes, Your Honor. So basically, if two phones are connected to a cloud account, that the theory is that the theory is that
somehow they'll eat each other's content?
Well, that essentially they create mirror images of each other. So a photo...
Was there any evidence to that effect that took place in this situation?
This is coming from Captain MJ's affidavit. He sort of explains this is the theory that we were looking at, and it also comes in from Mr. Pinner's affidavit, the Apple employee who talks about this as well.
Well, yes.
But there was also, I think, to better answer your question, Your Honor, the government's expert in cross-examination, and importantly, this happened after the defense consulted with its expert, he was asked, would it surprise you kick messages could be retrieved from the iCloud found on any PC or iPhone? Correct. That opened the door to the cloud sync theory. That's ultimately what Captain MJ was arguing in closing argument that had opened the door to this. So you have one...
My question was the door open. My question is the theory worthless, or does the theory have anything behind it?
The theory has behind it what the government expert admitted on cross-examination.
Which was,
would it surprise you that these messages could be retrieved from the iCloud found on any PC or iPhone? Correct. Or that these messages could be found on any PC or iPhone? Correct. So that is essentially...
You mean it wouldn't surprise me?
Well, he said...
That's an ambiguous answer to me.
It opened the door, though, to...
Well, I know it opened the door. That's not my point. This theory is hanging out there like a cloud, but it never seems to be attached to anything. It's just something that got thrown out. It's some piece of cybernetic something or other that makes people's mouths fall open. At least it makes my mouth fall open. But I can't see what it shows.
But I think the problem is when you did not put Gerard's testimony in, because the crux of his testimony was, I borrowed an iPhone from the accused, and I was using that to text these.
Right, and the forensic expert said, no way that's true.
Well, not that he could not have borrowed a phone. If you think there's only one phone, that might be the case. But the evidence was that there were two phones.
But don't we need to look...
Sorry, the evidence was also that it took place where the account was.
That's right.
Well, that the photos were taken, and that's the word used by the expert. The selfies of the accused were taken by the accused. I don't think you need a DFE to understand. You don't need a DFE for that.
You don't need a what?
You don't need a DFE to...
What's
say...
What's a DFE?
The digital forensic examiner. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
But... The fact that he was taking photos of himself, I don't think that's not surprising. The cloud sync is basically those photos or messages could appear on a phone that Gerard was using that he had been borrowed. And the reason is if they were borrowed, there's a connection between the phones.
Don't we need to look at this in the broader factual context where the interaction between trial defense counsel and his own client, where defense counsel essentially says to the accused, hey, I have found out that this idea of sharing with Gerard, the initial theory, isn't supported based on the digital forensic examiner. And then the accused says, okay, well, would you believe this? Cloud sync. And then when the accused is informed that the digital forensic examiner is saying that's highly unlikely, the accused then says, you know what, I guess I won't testify. Don't we have to look at that in the context of determining whether the trial defense counsel was making an informed ethics decision here about whether he should be introducing Gerard's testimony?
I think the problem is we have conflicting affidavits on that point. At what point was this introduced? The Army Corps determined the appellant was bringing this up in the middle of trial, but we have evidence that before trial he was conducting experiments with the second chair defense counsel. So to the extent that this is false because it was presented as sort of a last-ditch effort, that's clearly conflicted by the affidavits, and it's not a determination that this court can make at this point under the Ginn factors.
Counsel, may I ask a question? What is appellant's current position on whether the Article 32 testimony was false or perjured?
You mean, I guess, my position on it, Your Honor?
Yes.
Your Honor, I think there's a conflict between the experts about the – it's not a firm factual basis to conclude that it was false or that the cloud sync was false, because you have experts sort of providing different opinions, the government on cross and the defenses, to the extent that that can be read as the – let me back up. To the extent you could read the defense experts' affidavit to say that this isn't possible, and again, we don't say that that's the case. But in addition, you have BG come in and testify. And what she testified to interlocks with Gerard's testimony. She said, I met up with someone. It doesn't appear to be the guy sitting over at counsel's table, someone who kind of looked like him. And Gerard, in his testimony, saying, I met up with and had sex with someone by the name of BG.
What is appellant's current position, appellant's counsel's belief on whether Gerard exists and is an actual witness who claims to be who he is?
Your Honor, that was not, I will say, below at the Army Court, we attempted to introduce an ID card of Gerard as well as a second affidavit from him. The ACCA did not admit those documents because they did not make their determination on whether or not he did exist. But I will say, when he called in to the Article 32 and testified over the phone, the Article 32 PHO apparently believed he existed and, in fact, found there wasn't even probable cause for any of the charges or specifications. So I do.
Can I ask you a question here about the ineffectiveness claim? You've raised it a couple of times now. Isn't there enough conflict and confusion on this issue with regard to what defense counsel knew what and which defense counsel told the other one what and what the accused told and what the examiner said? Isn't that enough for us to simply send it back for debate hearing on the ineffectiveness claim? That's the first question.
Yes, Your Honor. I see my time has expired. If I can
answer the question.
If the court's asking, do we need to have a debate, we're not saying no. If the court believes it can't resolve the legal issue without getting further clarification on the facts, I don't think that's an issue.
Right.
The question is.
Well, let me ask you this then.
Yes.
Does the ineffectiveness claim, in your view, does it affect or impact the issue on the adultery charge and the dismissal of that charge? In other words, could the court simply resolve that issue and send it back for a debate hearing on all of this confusion with regard to who Gerard was, who Julio was, and all this other stuff?
I understand. So the question is, I guess, can we hold off on the mistrial issue and order a debate in the meantime? Is that?
No, I think my question is, can we just simply resolve the mistrial issue on the adultery charge and still send it back for a debate hearing on the other stuff?
I think if this court resolves, obviously if they find that he abuses discretion and should have granted a mistrial on all charges and specifications, then I don't think that a debate would be necessary for the ineffectiveness. You could just rule on that issue. That would be one road that this court could take.
Or could we say that irrespective of the confusion in the record, that there is enough in the record for the defense counsel to have reasonably believed that it was perjured testimony and they had an ethical obligation not to introduce it? I mean, you do agree that there is an ethical obligation not to introduce perjured testimony, don't you?
If you know that the testimony is perjured, you are prohibited under the ethics rules from introducing it. But the question is, did he know? Did he have a firm factual basis for knowing that?
Well, or did he reasonably suspect it?
Well, if you reasonably suspect it, then the ethics
rules. Then it's up to you to, right. Okay.
And you need
but to. Then I, you know.
Then and, you need,
so if it's reasonably up to you and you make your decision, how is that ineffective assistance of counsel if you are permitted and required under the ethics rules to make those decisions?
The problem is if it's up to you and it's in your discretion, you have to have a tactical reason for not putting in exculpatory testimony that fits your theory.
Which is you don't think it's true.
I'm sorry?
Which you think it's a fraud on the court.
Well, no, if you, the ethics rules say you have the authority not to put it in, if you, but you have to have a tactical reason and a firm factual basis for making that determination.
Well, isn't fraud on the court a tactical reason?
And even if that's not the issue, if you're going to have a forensic examiner come in and say, this doesn't make sense, or if your client's going to be picked apart when he's up on the witness stand, isn't that a tactical reason?
But again, none of those, Captain MJ never gave any of those reasons in his affidavit. And I think that is the problem here, is he does not explain that. So the extent that needs to be resolved at a Dubé, I think maybe that's an appropriate consideration.
May I ask one last question? Do you have any response to the government's good faith argument with respect to the Carpenter issue?
Your Honor, we believe absolutely that Carpenter applies in the military context and needs to be it applies in the military context.
How does that answer the 311 question that you're being asked?
Your Honor, we submit on our pleadings with regard to the third issue.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Dookie, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Carrie Marin, and along with my co-counsel, Major Craig Shapira, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court because appellant fails to meet each burden upon him. He fails to show deficient performance, he fails to show prejudice, and he fails to show an abuse of discretion in the military judge's chosen remedial action. Additionally, he consented to and then later waived any objection that he had to his cell site location information. And pending this court's preferences, I'll turn first to the IAC assignment of error. Faced with charges of messaging, lewd messages with minors, and possession of child pornography, appellant offers his defense counsel his first line of defense. My brother visited me in New York. He sent these messages from New York when I went to Louisiana. And at the 32, in reliance on that theory provided by the client, the telephonic witness cemented that theory, claiming to have sent these messages from New York. But the problem is that cold, hard metadata disproved this theory. And now appellant is saying that his attorney is deficient for not introducing the very testimony that cold, hard metadata disproved. And what he has critically failed to do is demonstrate any prejudice in how the results of his proceeding would be different. The first way that he has failed this is that the government's case was simply overwhelming. The phone was in Louisiana. It was not in New York. We know this as a matter of digital forensic evidence. These geolocations assigned to the phones. It doesn't necessarily matter that the appellant was taking selfies with his phone. What matters is when that photograph was captured, there are geo-coordinates assigned to that that's plotted on a map. So this iPhone 6 was in the state of Louisiana and not in the state of New York, as this alleged unseen brother testified at the 32. The government.
Can I get beyond the facts here?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what is the standard that a trial defense counsel has to bear in mind when making an ethical determination about whether to present evidence? Is it reasonable certainty? Is it some other standard?
Your Honor, it's under Rule 3.3 in the Rules of Professional Conduct, whether he shall not offer it or he may refuse to offer it. And in terms of assessing what he believed in U.S. v. Barker, we ask whether there was a firm factual basis to believe that the testimony was false and whether he conducted sufficient investigation. And so in this case, per the affidavit, and also corroborated by the defense expert consultant, this defense attorney did indeed conduct that sufficient investigation. He consulted both theories, not only the theory that his brother was in New York, but also the second cloud sync theory with his expert consultant, who had 20 years in the field, a resume in the joint appendix, that told his defense attorney that this cannot be true. And so that, for purposes of this case, Your Honor, is enough to dispose of whether or not the defense attorney had a firm factual basis. Certainly there was enough indicia just of the sketchiness of this overall testimony and the fact that this person has yet to be seen in person. But our position is that the defense attorney made this decision because he understood that he owes a candor to the tribunal. And it's a dangerous precedent that appellant is attempting to establish here, essentially taking away the discretion of the defense attorneys when they are trying to make this decision, effectively having them risk their law license versus committing a fraud upon the court. And so when you have a sworn affidavit from a defense attorney saying that this is the reason why I did not introduce this testimony, he can't be faulted for that, and he's certainly not able to be found ineffective.
Counsel, on this point, this isn't necessarily the argument that appellant makes, but was defense counsel ineffective in promising in the opening statement to produce the testimony when it appears that even at that time defense counsel had reason to believe that the testimony was false?
A number of points to that, Your Honor. The first is that at the time he made that promise in the opening statement, there still was a viable second theory about this cloud sink theory that he had not yet vetted with his defense expert consultant. And so it could be that he is doing what we ask of defense attorneys everywhere, that they can accept improbable but yet possible theories, and he moved out with that.
But wasn't it reckless to do that, knowing that they didn't know whether that was going to be true and that they would soon find out afterwards? And that, why did they need to promise it? I mean, if it had come up later, they could have used it.
Your Honor, it was not best practice, but it was not ineffective. It might not have passed muster under a trial advocacy 101, but it certainly wasn't falling below the objective performance that we expect of normally, of ordinarily fallible attorneys everywhere. And so,
Captain Merritt, didn't he raise it again in his closing argument, though?
Your Honor, in the closing, he did again what we expect defense attorneys to do, and that's draw conclusions based upon the facts that were lawfully adduced at the trial. He wasn't relying on the perjured testimony from this Article 32. He was relying on evidence that he indeed brought.
Well, I think the question is kind of what I have the same question that Judge Maggs has, is that if he was so concerned about the reliability of this Article 32 testimony, why promise it at the opening? Later on during the trial, you find out it is completely, I suppose, in the counsel's viewpoint, not a viable theory, but then raise it again on closing argument.
He raised it again, Your Honor, because he admitted evidence that the brother was still indeed to blame. And he actually indeed got the alibi instruction from the military judge for one of the specifications on the charge sheet. He had a witness testify that the person with whom she had sexual intercourse with was not the person matching the appellant, and that when they were at the apartment, that this person said, "Apologize for the condition of my brother's Jeep, and we've got to leave soon because my brother's coming home." And then he also gets concessions out of the CID agent on cross-examination discussing the statement that the appellant made during his interview. Two points on that. The first is that I just don't want to forget is that the appellant told CID that nobody used his phone. So that just kind of factors into these constantly changing theories that he's offering. But the defense attorney he might be fighting with one hand tied behind his back because he's dealing with a client offering him these changing theories, but he still introduces this theory, this alibi theory, at trial. And when he argues this in closing, it's not showing just recklessness. It's showing that he is continuing to zealously represent his client continuing to further the duty that he owes to his client. Maybe hindsight leads him to regret his choice for what he promised in the opening, but we look objectively from what he knew at the time that he made his promise. And that's the exact type of second-guessing that Strickland aims to eliminate, especially under with ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
Isn't there some issue of what the counsel knew and when they knew it between the two defense members of the defense team?
There's a factual discrepancy regarding the second theory in terms of phones syncing. So the assistant defense attorney talked about how they were trying to demonstrate that when they called one phone, that this other phone rang, because they're both iPhones and they're on the same network and they'll ring at the same time. There's nothing in the record that shows that there's a factual discrepancy regarding Kick, and that's how Julio was communicating with these people. That aside, Your Honor, our position still remains that it doesn't matter necessarily when and what theories the assistant defense attorney and the defense attorney knew. It was that these are constantly varying versions of events, and at the appellant's behest, he's wasting his defense attorney's resources. The defense attorney is investigating these things. He's cementing Article 32 testimony based off of the first theory.
Right, but if the two defense lawyers on the same team can't agree on when the theories and what theories were propounded at any given time, isn't that a problem?
We don't read both of those affidavits, Your Honor, as inconsistent. We believe they both can be true at the same time. They're just talking about two separate theories and two separate lines of investigation. And it is true, you'll note from Captain MJ's affidavit, Your Honor, that they kind of divided and conquered, and that he was running down a couple of leads while his assistant defense attorney was also running down a couple leads. And so they weren't necessarily having these conversations together with their defense expert consultant. So I don't think that should cause this court any concern.
What are we to make of the CCA judges? Maybe attack is too strong a word, but admonishment of the assistant defense counsel here.
It's true that when you're assessing the attorney's performance, it's joint and several, and it appears from her affidavit that she just did not understand or grasp that notion. But as far as how it impacts your decision about whether these defense attorneys were ineffective, I think it simply shows that reasonable minds can differ, and that two legally trained defense attorneys may have taken two separate avenues of approach on a legal issue, but the lead defense attorney who decided not to introduce this testimony cannot be found to be ineffective because he still was able to articulate the reasons why he didn't introduce it, despite his disagreement with his assistant defense attorney. And again, I know I said this, but she was not present for his in-person consultation with his defense expert consultant, which is that firm factual basis that led him to believe that it was false. Turning to the second assignment of error.
Counsel, one more question on that first one. What was the responsibility of trial counsel, defense counsel, and the hearing officer at the Article 32 to determine whether the telephonic witness was a real person who claimed to be, well, it was a real person, but was a person who claimed to be a real person?
Yes, Your Honor. Under MRE 304, the Article 32 rules, Your Honor, that this was a person that they called, and then the government didn't have any objection to this person testifying by telephone. The rules have been substantially relaxed, and so the government doesn't necessarily concede that this 32 testimony ultimately would have been admissible at trial, but as far as the facts before the court, when weighing what the defense attorney knew at the time he was trying to decide to introduce his testimony, that despite multiple subpoenas and government attempting to serve him with it and coordinate his travel, the phone was disconnected and never to be seen or heard from again. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor. Moving to the second assignment of error, this military judge was vigilant. He resorted to the second most extreme remedy available to him, and now appellant faults him for not opting for what this court has called as the ultimate last resort. But what he's failed to do here is to show that this military judge abused his discretion in his chosen remedial action. This actually was an appropriate response for three reasons, and the first is that he dismissed with prejudice the only specification that was impacted, and that's the adultery. To this notion, the military judge issued a 7-page written findings of fact and conclusions of law to this notion. And to some of the discussion earlier with the defense appellate attorney, I'd just like to point out that this military judge did not give the government credit for what they had not yet done. The government may have promised things as to the breadcrumbs or the pearls that they were later going to string together at trial, but the government had not yet done that. They promised an opening, but the military judge gave an instruction, as it applies to the IAC situation as well, that opening statements are not evidence. And then the actual the Prosecution Exhibit 7 for identification remained for identification. That did not go back with the panel members. And then finally, what's left is what the facts on the record simply. There's no crossover between the adultery and the remaining specifications.
Counsel, why wasn't it an abuse of discretion for the military judge to strike all of MR's testimony? Specifically, why wasn't it an abuse of discretion for the military judge to strike MR's testimony that the accused was not Julio?
It was not an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, because he was taking one of the most protective mechanisms to the appellant to ensure that the appellant had the fair trial. Now, cited at Joint Appendix 408, when there is discussion as to this exculpatory testimony that she gave at trial, at Joint Appendix 410, the military judge said, "Well, defense, you can call this witness in your case in chief, can you not?" And the defense attorney said, "Oh, yes, absolutely," and agreed with that, but then articulated that he did not do so because of the taint. And the military judge shut it down at that point because he said that this instruction that he provided to the panel specifically disrepudiated any notion of a bribe. And so it was not an abuse of discretion to give the appellant one of the most protective options available, especially when appellant could have turned around and called that witness in their case in chief to introduce this exculpatory testimony. And the record in this case actually shows a very engaged, obedient panel willing to follow these instructions, with one panel member indeed raising their hand and indicating an affirmative response. The appellant was found guilty of all the charges and specifications, but they did find him guilty by exceptions and substitutions in one of the specifications for the month that the appellant possessed the child pornography. Our position simply is that it's difficult to argue this type of cold, hard metadata at trial. So given the Fletcher factors and looking at the prejudice analysis and the back end of this mistrial analysis, our position is that the appellant fails to show that this military judge abused his discretion. Just a couple final points on this mistrial that I want to note for the judge, for you, Your Honor, is that the defense attorney on Joint Appendix 213 filed a motion to preclude witness identification at trial. So now he stands before you arguing that he did not get to introduce this testimony that would have been helpful for him when the defense attorney actually was trying to keep that out at trial. And unlike Diaz, where there's two experts who said that the appellant murdered the daughter and opined on the ultimate opinion, this is a situation that while prosecutors are allowed to make strong blows, they cannot make foul ones. This was a foul one, but this was not such that these chosen remedial action was inappropriate. It's just worth noting that we would be having a separate conversation if the government did not turn over information that this witness couldn't identify the appellant. But that's not what happened here. The government simply did not turn over information that she was bribed, and that's helpful to the appellant, but it's marginally beneficial. As appellant, I'll remain on my pleadings for the third assignment of error unless this court has questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Your Honor, with respect to the ineffectiveness, I do think it bears repeating that Captain MJ got up before the panel and promised specifically to play this testimony that would exculpate his client. And at the end of trial, once again, he's arguing that the brother did it through the cloud sink. To the extent that he was, he had a factual basis, it was an investigation that was happening in the middle of trial on their central theory of the case. That's simply too little. That's too late. And it was unresponsive to the evidence as was coming out during the particularly during the defense's case in chief. The government experts' answers on cross-examination and VG's testimony coming out that corroborated what Girard had been saying. So he did not have a firm factual basis to conclude that he was prohibited from introducing this testimony. With respect to the mistrial, I just want to make one point about the pretrial motion about precluding the identification of the witnesses. As a defense counsel, you have to acclimate, you have to pivot at trial when evidence comes out that maybe you weren't expecting at the time. And clearly when MR came out with this and then VG said exactly the same thing, basically that is exonerating the client or pointing fingers at somebody else. They have to be able to respond and present that testimony. So this pretrial motion about excluding identification should not be given any credit by the court. Pending any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess, pending further order of the court.